All right, as we talked about last week in Revelation 16, these latter verses, I'm just going to very quickly blast through this, as I said, for recording purposes, since I was not able to record it last week. We got the cycle of the seven vials or bowls of wrath being poured out in the 17 through 21, and the seven bowls have been poured out upon every aspect of nature. In other words, the things that you're seeing going on in this chapter, in keeping with the symbolic imagery and the metaphorical use of language in the book, is meant to convey that the judgment, every aspect of creation in the larger metaphysical sense. And what I mean by that is not so much, okay, there are going to be literal earthquakes and literal typhoons and tsunamis and all this stuff, but these are all metaphors for quantum change or cataclysmic paradigm-shifting change. And from the standpoint of the first century Jew, the destruction of the temple, the coming of the Messiah, that's what you're talking about. Paradigm change. Upheaval. And I mentioned last week about the whole question of the statement that we find in these verses about the plague being poured out in the air. And we sort of have this interplay between what could be considered the literal fulfillment of the events as recorded by the Jewish historian Josephus in the Roman attack and eventually destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple, where you have the stench of rotting corpses and upwards of 600,000 who were slaughtered or died of starvation or some of the other things that were going on. And then I ask you to note the parallel in the words of Jesus in chapter 19, verse 30 of the Gospel of St. John, and those in verse 17 of Revelation 17, where you still, in both places, you have, it is finished, it is done. Now, the interesting thing is that, at least among Protestant evangelical reformed types, I don't know of anybody who says that in some measure the work of Christ is not yet finished in terms of redemption, that there was something lacking on the cross. And we almost all universally look upon his words that it's finished as a definitive statement of that. However, there's also a sense in which the "it is done" part of Revelation 16 is a further confirmation of what had happened just 30 years prior in the crucifixion and resurrection, and that the finishing of Christ's work also had reverberations into the changing of the Old Testament age into the New Testament age, and that change could not literally be fulfilled as long as the temple was standing. As long as there was this visible manifestation and representation that summarized and gave the highest visible explanation and inspiration for the old way, the old system, the new was never really going to take off, because there would always be this tendency for the earliest followers of Jesus, who were Jews, to identify with that old system. And so in some measure it had to go. And we have these two different translations of verse 18, and there were flames and voices and thunders, and there was a great earth shock, so that never from the time when men were on earth had there been so great an earth shock so full of power. There again you have the use of exaggerated metaphor and language, but if you're looking for a literal fulfillment of it, there was something like that that took place during the Roman siege, as recorded by Josephus in Book 4, Chapter 4.5 of his Wars of the Jews. And then in verse 19 we have this interesting statement about the great city being split into three parts, and I mentioned how the Jews had fought as much among themselves during the Roman siege as they had fought the Romans, and there was all this instability and political disorder. You had these three factions. So, in a sense, in terms of the different groups within the city, you had these three major factions. So you've got a division there, in a sense. But the city itself was also physically divided into three sections. And we talked about the mass starvation that there was, and I gave you these rather grisly words from Josephus' account of some of the things that took place about how people turned on each other. You know, when people are starving, they will do very, very horrific things to feed themselves. And I thank the Lord we don't have to deal with something like that, most of us. And so, this is something that went on at that time in the city of Jerusalem. And then we have the statement, and the cities of the nations fell, or the Gentile cities fell, that I mentioned, how in terms of the Romans attacking the city, there was a lot of collateral casualty. The Romans just didn't, with blinders on, ignore everything around them and head straight for Jerusalem. They took their time and they helped themselves to anything along the way that might increase their manpower, their wealth, their holdings in some way, shape, or form. And so there was a sense in which there were Gentile cities, here metaphorically referred to as nations, that fell in the process of the attack against Jerusalem. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. I mentioned that that term remembered is a covenantal term, and you find it in Scripture being used most often about God visiting covenantal judgment. But it is never used to describe God's judgment against pagan cities. It's always used to describe his judgment against his own people, against Israel and Jerusalem in particular. And you note these words, to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. The covenantal judgment of God is pictured as a wine cup overflowing, and this harkens back to the words of Jesus in Matthew 23, where in the way it's recorded in Matthew, at least, just prior to his expounding to his disciples the coming destruction of the city of Jerusalem that's given to us in Matthew 24, he has this encounter with the leaders of the Jews in which he pronounces seven curses upon them. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. There are seven of those. And one of the things he says is he uses this same imagery about filling up the cup to the brim, the boiling point, and going ahead and finishing that which your forefathers started. It's coming upon you. And every island fled away and no mountains were to be found. We saw these references in Jeremiah and Psalms and Ezekiel. In the language of apocalyptic and prophetic speech, hills and mountains are used to metaphorically portray people and nations and islands. And in chapter 16, verse 20, we have a prediction that when God's wrath is poured out upon Israel, there would be no allies, therefore, found to help her. They would all flee, not to be found. And I mentioned how the hailstones that are mentioned here, again, if there was a literal fulfillment of it, we have this striking example given to us from the writings of Josephus, where the stones that the Roman catapults were hurling over the city were white in color, and they fell upon people and killed them until the Jews got kind of wise about how to avoid that. And does anybody remember what, I'm going to show it to you in a minute, but does anybody remember what the Romans did to address that problem, to make it more effective? They painted them black, right? They weren't as easily seen. And Josephus gives that account. But we saw here, though, this is another tie-in with Israel now becoming like Sodom and Egypt, which we read in chapter 11 of the book of Revelation, the city where our Lord was crucified, which is mystically called Sodom and Egypt. Lo and behold, one of the plagues against Egypt was these hailstones. And that's the account from Josephus. And we have these words of the prophets in Isaiah. The message of the seals and the trumpets and the bowls of wrath is the same. The focus of all God's covenant judgment was now turned upon Israel because she would not heed the words of the last and great prophet, Jesus of Nazareth. And you find the reference there in Matthew 23, 31 to 38, where he again is in that mode of pronouncing this judgment against the leaders, using that same kind of language. All right. Now, if you'll just bear with me a moment, I want to go right into chapter 17. To find it on my desktop here. And we've got a nice different color scheme going for you here. All right. All right. Chapter 17 of the Apocalypse contains a noteworthy chronology where there is a reference to these kings. And this is significant for the purpose of locating and more further confirming the date and place of the events of the book. One of the things that is important to the past fulfillment view, the preteristic view of prophecy in the New Testament, is the dating of the book of Revelation. And we typically find evidence either for or against that, depending on your perspective, in one of two ways. It's what's called external evidence and internal evidence. From the standpoint of Reformed biblical interpretation, the internal evidence is the most significant because we come to the Bible presupposing that it is the infallible Word of God, and therefore it has priority over anything else. And so the internal evidence that we find within the book of Revelation itself that gives us very definite clues about the date of its writing and the context, we go with that first and foremost. And we've already seen some things that would seem to indicate to us that the temple was still standing, for example, when this book was written. John is told in a vision to go and measure the temple. It simply would be very difficult to believe that had the temple already been destroyed, and again, to put this on some kind of relevant scale for us, it would be as if someone was writing about things going on in the United States 30 years after the White House, the Washington Monument, and most of Washington, D.C. was totally destroyed by an enemy attack and never mentioning it. That's just inconceivable. And you have something like that going on here. And so we have all these things going on in the book of Revelation that would seem to indicate that it was written prior to the destruction of the temple, or at least about the time those things would have been taking place. And the relevant portions we find in verse 3 and verses 6 to 13. And let's look at some of these verses. I'm going to be jumping around this chapter a little bit. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Now, these images I use, I mean, they're primarily just to keep you a little visually stimulated here. But you can just about see it. I don't know. Unfortunately, it's getting a little washed out because of this this one here. You can see to some extent how absurd it is to take these things literally. I mean, when you try to portray this in a visual form, it really looks kind of ridiculous. You know, and it's like taking something that really wasn't meant to be used for a particular purpose, and it just doesn't quite fit, it doesn't quite work. And again, I think that's the case with this. But at any rate, it serves as an interesting symbolic representation. And that's what I'm talking about here. As the angel carried John away in the spirit, John saw the woman on the beast. Now, these words are placed in quotes to emphasize that we're not dealing with literal seeing or being carried away in a spatial or physical sense. And as New Testament scholar Dr. Ken Gentry points out, there was a revelatory vision experience. By definition, those sorts of things are symbolic representations of prophetic truths or events. And again, I to try to give you another example of this that would be in a little different context, but maybe just as meaningful. How many of you have either read or seen a Sherlock Holmes short story or movie? Now, you know, I love Sherlock Holmes. I don't read those stories as much as I used to, but the old Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce, Sherlock Holmes movies, you know, I think to millions of people around the world, these people are real. They're real characters. And, you know, there's 221B Baker Street and all these characters, dear old Mrs. Hudson and the inspector from Scotland Yard, his name escapes me just now. But, of course, they're not real characters in the sense that there really was a Sherlock Holmes. Everybody knows that, right? I hope I'm not sending anybody away disillusioned here. They were characters made up by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Well, you set the same thing here. These are real events in some sense, but they're coming to us within the context of literary representation. And when I saw her, I marveled greatly with amazement, he says. I saw her, I was completely mystified. I stared at her completely amazed. I did wonder, having seen her, with great wonder. And in the Greek, the last sentence there, he literally says, I wondered with great wonder about this thing. You see. And there again, that's another indication about the mistaken idea of taking these things in a literal sense. He wouldn't have had any problem with this if it was something that really was to be taken literally, if he was seeing something that was like a report of, well, you got these Roman armies coming over here and this sort of thing. That's not what he saw. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman of the beast and that carries her, which has the seven heads." So even the angel calls it a mystery. But he also tells John that he, the angel, is going to provide him the application, the explanation of the vision. Now you notice in verse 1, I want you to open your Bibles if you don't have them open. I want you to go ahead and turn to chapter 17, even though I've got the things that I'm going to be referring to here on the board. I am going to be asking you to look at the text, and also I'm going to be asking for volunteers to read a few things here in just a moment. But you see a change in point of emphasis. In verse 1, he says, "I will show you," but in verse 7, it's, "I will tell you." He introduces John initially to the visual, the symbolic imagery, but then in verse 7, he now changes to the verbal exposition and explanation of what's being said. And now he says, "Here is the mind that has wisdom." The ESV has it. This calls for a mind with wisdom. Wisdom is following the angelic interpretation. It's needed because the visual representation has a twofold reference. That's why it's hard to figure. That's why he's going to have to be told what it symbolizes. Because it's not just one thing here. There's something he doesn't want, the angel doesn't want the author to miss. The seven heads are, number one, seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are also seven kings. And that's verses 9 to the first part of verse 10. And so without the angel's explanation, it might be misunderstood. The expression here is the mind that has wisdom is introducing the interpretation of a vision that he who follows the angelic interpretation will have the wisdom to understand it. Now, Dave Hunt is a very well-known dispensational author. You know, one of the interesting things about these type of topics is that you find that the people who write the most popular books about them, and Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins of the Left Behind series would be a notable exception to this. And there are several other notable exceptions, but it's interesting to me that regardless of where people are on the scale in terms of what they believe about this, you have these people that, if you'll excuse me for saying so, they lack qualification to expound on these things. Now, that's not to say that God can't use some people to get the church's attention or to talk about something that better educated men aren't paying attention to. That can certainly happen. And I think to some extent God used Dave Hunt for that purpose back in the 80s. But I'm mentioning this about him because Dave Hunt has written many, many best-selling prophecy books, from the dispensational, premillennial, seven-year tribulation, rapture's about to happen point of view. But guess what? Dave Hunt's never been to seminary a day in his life. He's never even been to Bible college a day in his life. He's an accountant by trade, which is all the more reason not to pay a lot of attention to it. I'm just kidding. Accountants are fine people. But does anybody remember or happen to know what his first big book was? It really didn't have anything directly to do with Bible prophecy, but it was a terrifically important book, and I think it was his best one, and one that somebody needed to write, and the Lord used him to write it. Does anybody remember? It's called The Seduction of the Spirit, and he wrote it back in the mid-80s. And what he was arguing was that there were all these New Age type of influences coming into the church. And he named some names. He talked about Robert Schuller, for example, and a few other people who were buying into teachings, and he had very clear proof of this, that were being imported into the church and being used. That was a very important work. I mean, you could tell it wasn't written by somebody who was a scholar, but it was very well footnoted and had a tremendous impact. But he's made his subsequent career writing books on prophecy, and this book came out a few years ago, A Woman Rides the Beast. It gained him a certain amount of notoriety, Because this, as the book, this is a little blurb from the book. In Revelation 17, the Apostle John describes in great detail the characteristics of a false church that will be the partner of the Antichrist. Was he describing the Roman Catholic Church? Well, I can tell you, to save you time from reading the book, Dave Hunt says yes, he was. To answer that question, Dave Hunt has spent years gathering research and indisputable historical documentation, primarily Catholic sources, providing information not generally available. So this is why you need to get this book, even though you've got all those other prophecy books. Old Dave here has some stuff that's not generally available. So he raises this question, and this is one of the issues within dispensationalism and the difference that we have with that side of prophecy and also the historicist approach, because at least in his brand of dispensationalism, he sees the Roman Catholic Church co-opted and corrupted as the whore of Babylon. Now, he had some historical precedent for that. Martin Luther used that kind of terminology to describe the Roman Catholic Church in his day. But Luther was not a dispensationalist. He was more from the historicist standpoint. But so we're faced with this question, who is the whore, the prostitute, the great harlot? What does the Bible say? Note the following biblical references to spiritual or covenantal harlotry. In every one of these references, the Bible is speaking of either Israel or Jerusalem as being guilty of the sin. All right, I'd like a volunteer to read Isaiah 1:21. Who would like to do that? Linda? Okay, Linda DeMeo. Isaiah 57:3. Who would please read that for us? I got it. Okay, Jim Carnes, I got to see your hand. I can't do the Vulcan mind meld and know that this is what you're wanting to do. Ezekiel 16:15. Who'll read that for us, please? Ezekiel 16:15. Sam Ogden and Jeremiah 2:20. Okay, Bob Linden. All right, so we've got this imagery of whoredom or harlotry or prostitution. Isaiah 1:21.
How the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice. Righteous lodged in it. But now, murderers.
Wow. Read that again.
How the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice. Righteous lodged in it. But now, murderers.
And by the way, he's not talking about Saratoga Springs there. He's talking about Jerusalem, okay? All right, Isaiah 57:3.
But come here, you sons and sorceress, you offspring of the adulterer and the harlot.
Another reference to the people of Israel, and the people of Judah in particular in this case, whose city was Jerusalem. Ezekiel 16:15.
But thou hast trusted in thine own beauty and placed the heart of harlot because of thy renown, and poured out thy fornications on everyone that passed by.
Yeah, we're just taking little chunks of these passages, but if you go back and look at the context, you'll find I'm not misleading you, I'm not making this up. These are all things God said against Old Covenant Israel. Jeremiah 2:20. As I say, I'm going from the red letter system to the yellow letter system here. In every one of these references, the Bible is speaking of either Israel or Jerusalem as being guilty of the sin of spiritual harlotry. Now, based on what the apocalypse has previously shown us, we can conclude then that the Babylonian harlot is the city of Jerusalem, which has already been identified with Sodom and Egypt, and the corrupt, compromised leaders of Israel who were responsible for preferring Roman power to God's covenant and responsible for the death of Jesus, their Messiah. Now, the beast has already been shown to be either the power of the Roman Empire generally and its visible manifestation of that power in the emperor, which in this case is Nero. Now, in verses 4 through 6, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and glittered with gold and jewels and pearls. and she was holding a gold wine cup filled with the disgusting filth of her prostitution. On her forehead was written the name, a cryptic name, Babylon the Great, the mother of all the prostitutes and all the filthy practices on the earth. I saw that she was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I was completely mystified. Now that's from the New Jerusalem Bible translation. You see, if we didn't have verse 6, you might be able to come up with a number of different theories as to who this Babylon the Great was. But number 6 fairly well nails it down, doesn't it? Drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Now, can someone tell me, and this, you don't have to go back, but if you were paying attention to the early part of this lesson or last week, where did Jesus talk about this? Jesus made reference to this very thing. Can somebody tell me? Matthew 23. That cycle of 7 woes of judgment. How terrible will it be for you teachers of religious law, this is the New Living Translation, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets for your ancestors that your ancestors killed and decorate the graves of the godly people your ancestors destroyed. Then you say, we never would have joined them in killing the prophets. And saying that, you are accusing yourselves of being the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. I will send you prophets and wise men and teachers of the religious law. You will kill some by crucifixion and whip others in your synagogues, chasing them from city to city. As a result, you will become guilty. Now notice, it's a very definite, direct pronunciation of judgment against a specific group of people at a specific time in history, in redemptive history. You will become guilty of murdering all the godly people from righteous Abel to Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered in the temple between the altar and the sanctuary. I assure you, all the accumulated judgment of the centuries will break upon the heads of this very generation. Drunk with the blood of the saints and the martyrs of Jesus. All right. Now, another thing that you have going on here in this chapter, and then especially in this latter section of the book of Revelation, and we're in the last quadrant of it, chapter 17 to 22, you've got this increasing contrast between the New Jerusalem and the Old Jerusalem. And you see the attributes here. The New Jerusalem, which, by the way, who or what is the New Jerusalem? Who can tell me? I'm sorry? Yes. The church. The followers of Jesus. The people who, according to Revelation, who are the true Israel. The people who are the true followers of the true God are all of those who are members of the synagogue of Jesus, who are the followers of the true Messiah. They constitute a new Jerusalem. And the earthly Jerusalem served its purpose for a while, but it even in its heyday, even when it was doing exactly what it should have done, it was only a mirror image of that which was perfect and absolutely holy in heaven. And with the shifting of the old covenant into the new age of the new covenant, there's no longer a need for this earthly manifestation. And so you've got the heavenly Jerusalem, the earthly Jerusalem, the city with its foundation in God, in the Messiah, and it's a continuing city, a city that is eternal. But then you've got the old Jerusalem, which is not a continuing city. It has a terminal point. The city whose builder is God, the city whose builder is man, the Jerusalem which is to come, the Jerusalem which now is, the Jerusalem which is above, the Jerusalem which is beneath, that which is free, that which is in bondage, the holy city, the wicked city, the bride, which is the church of Jesus, and the harlot, which is the corrupted city of Jerusalem. And now we've got this business about the seven hills. This calls for a mind which has wisdom. Seven heads or seven mountains on which the woman is seated. Now, Rome, the Roman Empire, is symbolized here by the seven mountains. Rome is the one city in all of history that's been distinguished universally by its seven hills. And I give you here the names of the hills. Now, some people, even who take the past fulfillment view, they take a little different spin on this, and they want to make, I think, too fine a distinction between hills and mountains. I won't elaborate on that any more than to say that there are some people from the preteristic standpoint who take a different view as to the identity here, but they're a small minority. This point is well nigh indisputably certain. There is little doubt that a first century reader would understand this reference in any way other than as a reference to Rome, the city built on seven hills. Why would he need to refer to anything else? And it's difficult to believe, as I say here, that John would write to the seven historical churches, which that was told to you at the beginning of the book, in chapter 1, verse 11, whose members lived in an age of such great trouble that he's going to make reference to an evil power noted for its seven mountains and expect them to surmise that he spoke of something other than the reigning power of the Roman Empire. What about the kings? Well, the five kings have already fallen, the six now reigns, and the seventh is yet to come, but this reign will be brief. Now, this is where the wording gets a little hard to follow sometimes, and you kind of go cross-eyed trying to figure out what he's talking about. And it gets to be a bit of a challenge, even for our dispensational friends, as they try to plug in who this is going to be and what this is going to look like in the future. A timely, time-telling indicator. Five kings have fallen. One is. If there is any statement in the apocalypse that establishes it in a specific time and place and context, 1710 should certainly be that it. It's a simple biblical solution. And Tim LaHaye here and Jerry Jenkins, they aren't going to make any money selling books with this perspective, but you're going to get the biblical answer to the question. Okay? Find a series of seven kings, five of whom have fallen, the sixth of whom is still ruling, and the last of whom was but a short, brief reign. And the one who is will be the king alive and ruling at the time the apocalypse was written. And the discovery of the dates of his reign will serve then as a framework within which the writing of the apocalypse must have occurred. What kings and where? Now, everything that has previously been established about the context and the content and the timing of the events lead us to the well-founded conclusion that the kings referred to are, in fact, the emperors of Rome, of which this chap was one of them. Does anybody know who this is? Surely you know your Roman emperors. Wait, no, it wasn't Julius Caesar. This was Nero. This is Nero. This is a rendering of Nero Caesar. Roman emperors from the beginning of the imperial time of Rome to the end of the first century are listed here. Notice there are 10 of them. There are 10 of them here. And we start with Julius Caesar because prior to that time, Rome, although they had various leaders, they were primarily governed by what? SPQR. Senatus Populus Quae. Something Romanus. I think that's it. Senatus Populus Quae Romanus. To the Senate and the people of Rome. The Senate governed. But with Julius Caesar, that all changed. And one of the great, great turning points in Western civilization occurred when this man who is pictured here, Julius Caesar, although that may be Augustus Caesar, but when Julius Caesar made a very, very important decision, he was doing battle in Gaul, modern France, and he crossed a very famous river. Anybody know what the river was? He crossed the Rubicon. That was significant because the rule was no Roman legion was allowed to cross that river and enter Rome. I mean, they had a ways to go before they get to Rome. But he made a decision to cross that river and go back to Rome with his legionnaires to take over the city, or to deal with the political turmoil is a better way. And in doing that, he was violating a long-standing law and rule of the Roman Empire, such as existed at that time. You ever hear that phrase about crossing the Rubicon? That's where it comes from. At any rate, we date the beginning of the imperial era with Julius Caesar, and because we're only going to the end of the first century with this, we're stopping it here with Vespasian. But you see the listing here. And in order to get all this in, I'm going to have to kind of breeze through this. Seven kings have fallen. Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, and Claudius. One now is, which would be Nero. The other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. Now, Galba, who you see listed there as number seven, notice the extent of his reign. 68-69. It's clear, then, that the book of Revelation must be dated the reign of Nero, and consequently before his death in A.D. 68. He is the sixth king. The short-lived rule of the seventh king, Galba, has not yet come. Okay? And the beast that was and is not is himself the eighth. Now, this gets, I have to readily admit, very confusing and maybe hard to get a handle on. And this is another case where, as I said, there's not one particular view of prophetic interpretation that doesn't have its weaknesses. And certainly somebody could look at this and say, well, I think you're stretching things there a bit. And so I'll rephrase what I just said and say that there's not one particular view of New Testament prophecy that doesn't stretch things a bit. The question is, how much stretching are you willing to live with, and how much absurdity are you willing to live with in your stretching? You know, are you willing to live with locusts being black helicopters, like Hal Lindsey has told us? And all of these kinds of things, or with this kind of stretching that I'm about to share with you now. We've got a little Greek lesson we need to have here, because the New King James doesn't get this quite right. Is himself also the eighth? Now, in the Greek, the word the does not occur in that sentence. It doesn't have the definite article. And that's why in the ESV, you see it's translated as an eighth. And the NIV has it, an eighth. Now that's significant, because the definite article, as I said, is missing in the literal translation. The definite article that clearly and repetitively in the chapters leading up to this and the ones that follow, define the chronological series of kings. The five, the one, the one to come. It vanishes before the eighth is mentioned, and thus the eighth king is an eighth. That is, it refers not to any one particular individual, but in the scheme of things of this approach to interpretation, it refers to the revival of the Roman Empire itself under one who is outside of the originally specified seven kings. From the time of Nero to the time of Vespasian, Rome was in turmoil with civil strife and war throughout the empire, and it really appeared to be about to fall apart. But under Vespasian, it rose from the dead, in a metaphorical sense. It revived. It received a head wound and came back to life, in a sense. You know, if you're going to talk about a country or a political order being paralyzed from the top, you could refer to it as a head wound. You know, some people of the more futuristic interpretation who did not believe this was past, they looked upon the assassination of John Kennedy as a fulfillment of this type of thing, because he received a fatal head wound. So he must have been the Antichrist or something. There were people who seriously argued that back in the early 60s. You can see that's an example of the stretching you have to do if you take the futuristic approach to interpretation. Does anybody remember what Vespasian was doing before he became emperor? Exactly. He was the Roman general who initiated, Nero put him in charge of going to Jerusalem and destroying the Jewish revolt. But he had to stop right in the middle of it, because Rome was falling apart. Nero committed suicide. The place was just falling apart. The empire was crumbling. And when he got back to Rome with his legions, there was a little bit of political and civil strife, and his legions took control of things, and they proclaimed him, along with the full consent of the Senate, the new emperor. With the death of Nero, as I've just said, Under the next two emperors, Vespasian and Titus, Christianity would be left in peace for more than a decade. John clearly spoke of the events of his era as a true prophet of God, as one concerned for his fellow partakers in the tribulation. He did not overlook the earth-shaking events of his own era. He spoke directly to them. Now, you notice I got at the top. You've got these three keys to interpreting Revelation. Audience relevance, audience relevance, audience relevance. Those are your three keys. If you move away from what this would have meant to the intended audience, without taking that into account first and foremost, you're almost always going to come up with something that distorts the true meaning of the passage or the text under consideration. So in terms of what, and that's not by any means not the end of chapter 17, but in terms of those things, the seven hills, the kings, the beast, the harlot, I've tried to provide you there with a valid interpretation that is consistent with what the Bible itself says and with what we've been talking about. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, John. That's right. That's exactly right. And whereas it may be looked upon as something of a weakness of the position, simply because every study Bible and just about everybody you read says that the book was written during the time of Domitian and AD 96, the earlier interpreters of the book of Revelation in the 19th century and the 18th century, almost all gave it an early date. If I was sitting here giving this lecture to you in 1805 or 1705, it would not sound unusual at all. Everybody would just be under the assumption that the book was written prior to the destruction of the temple. You find the old commentaries written by the old scholars, and this was their position. Now, there were other people who argued for other datings, but you didn't have this predominance of this other view that you have today. Any other questions or comments?